Chapter 18. His tone was quiet and controlled, and the fact disconcerted her. As he had been ready to give him violence for violence, but this calm acceptance of things as they were left her without a weapon. "See here, Charity, you're always telling me I've got no rights over you. There might be two ways of looking at that, but I ain't going to argue it. All I know is I raised you as good as I could, and meant fairly by you always except once, for a bad half hour. There's no justice in weighing that half hour against the rest, and you know it. If you hadn't, you wouldn't have gone on living under my roof. Seems to me the fact of your doing that gives me some sort of a right, the right to try and keep you out of trouble. I'm not asking you to consider any other." She listened in silence, and then gave a slight laugh. "Better wait till I'm in trouble," she said. He paused a moment, as if weighing her words. "Is that all your answer?" "Yes, that's all." "Well, I'll wait." He turned away slowly, but as he did, so the thing she had been waiting for happened. The door opened again and Arnie entered. He stopped short with a face of astonishment, and then, quickly controlling himself, went up to Mr. Royal with a frank look. "Have you come to see me, sir?" he said coolly, throwing his cap on the table with an air of proprietorship. Mr. Royal again looked slowly about the room, then his eyes turned to the young man. "Is this your house?" he inquired. Arnie laughed. "Ell, as much as it's anybody's. I come here to sketch occasionally. And to receive Miss Royal's visits? When she does me the honor, is this the home you propose to bring her to when you get married?" There was an immense and oppressive silence. Charity, quivering with anger, started forward, and then stood silent, too humbled for speech. Harney's eyes had dropped under the old man's gaze, but he raised them presently, and looking steadily at Mr. Royal, said, "Miss Royal is not a child. Isn't it rather absurd to talk of her as if she were? I believe she considers herself free to come and go as she pleases, without any questions from anyone." He paused and added, "I'm ready to answer any she wishes to ask me." Mr. Royal turned to her. "Skm, when he's going to marry you?" Then there was another silence, and he laughed in his turn a broken laugh, with a scraping sound in it. "Who darst?" he shouted out with sudden passion. He went close up to Charity, his right arm lifted, not in menace, but in tragic exhortation. "You darst, and you know it, and you know why." He swung back again upon the young man. "And do you know why you ain't asked her to marry you, and why you don't mean to? It's because you hadn't need to, nor any other man either. I'm the only one that was fool enough not to know that. And I guess nobody'll repeat my mistake, not in Eagle County, anyhow. They all know what she is, and what she came from. They all know her mother was a woman of the town from Nettleton, that followed one of those mountain fellows up to his place, and lived there with him like a heathen. I saw her there 16 years ago, when I went to bring this child down. I went to save her from the kind of life her mother was leading, but I'd better have left her in the kennel she came from. ... He paused and stared darkly at the two young people, and out beyond them, at the menacing mountain with its rim of fire. Then he sat down beside the table on which they had so often spread their rustic supper, and covered his face with his hands. Harney leaned in the window, a frown on his face. He was twirling between his fingers a small package that dangled from a loop of string. Charity heard Mr. Royal draw a hard breath or two, and his shoulders shook a little. Presently he stood up and walked across the room. He did not look again at the young people. They saw him feel his way to the door and fumble for the latch, and then he went out into the darkness. After he had gone, there was a long silence. Charity waited for Arnie to speak, but he seemed at first not to find anything to say. At length he broke out irrelevantly. "Wonder how he found out?" She made no answer, and he tossed down the package he had been holding, and went up to her. "I'm so sorry, dear. ... that this should have happened. ... She threw her head back proudly. "Ain't ever been sorry, not a minute. No. She waited to be caught into his arms, but he turned away from her irresolutely. The last glow was gone from behind the mountain. Everything in the room had turned gray and indistinct, and an autumnal dampness crept up from the hollow below the orchard, laying its cold touch on their flushed faces. Harney walked the length of the room, and then turned back and sat down at the table. Come, he said imperiously. She sat down beside him, and he untied the string about the package, and spread out a pile of sandwiches. I stole them from the love feast at Hamblin, he said with a laugh, pushing them over to her. She laughed too, and took one, and began to eat. Didn't you make the tea? No, she said. Forgot, oh, well it's too late to boil the water now. He said nothing more, and sitting opposite to each other they went on silently eating the sandwiches. Darkness had descended in the little room, and Harney's face was a dim blur to Charity. Suddenly he leaned across the table, and laid his hand on hers. I shall have to go off for a while, a month or two, perhaps to arrange some things, and then I'll come back. And we'll get married. His voice seemed like a stranger's. Nothing was left in it of the vibrations she knew. Her hand lay inertly under his, and she left it there, and raised her head, trying to answer him. But the words died in her throat. They sat motionless, in their attitude of confident endearment, as if some strange death had surprised them. At length Harney sprang to his feet with a slight shiver. Odd. It's damp, we couldn't have come here much longer. He went to the shelf, took down a tin candlestick, and lit the candle. Then he propped an unhinged shutter against the empty window frame, and put the candle on the table. It threw a queer shadow on his frowning forehead, and made the smile on his lips a grimace. But it's been good, though, hasn't it, Charity? What's the matter? Why do you stand there staring at me? Haven't the days here been good? He went up to her, and caught her to his breast. Andy, there'll be others, lots of others. Jollier, even jollier. Won't there, darling? He turned her head back, feeling for the curve of her throat below the ear, and kissing here there, and on the hair and eyes and lips. She clung to him desperately, and as he drew her to his knees on the couch she felt as if they were being sucked down together into some bottomless abyss. XV, that night, as usual, they said goodbye at the wood's edge. Harney was to leave the next morning early. He asked Charity to say nothing of their plans till his return, and, strangely even to herself, she was glad of the postponement. A leaden weight of shame hung on her, benumbing every other sensation, and she bade him goodbye with hardly a sign of emotion. His reiterated promises to return seemed almost wounding. As he had no doubt that he intended to come back, her doubts were far deeper and less definable. Since the fanciful vision of the future that had flitted through her imagination at their first meeting, as he had hardly ever thought of his marrying her. She had not had to put the thought from her mind. It had not been there. If ever she looked ahead, she felt instinctively that the gulf between them was too deep, and that the bridge their passion had flung across it was as insubstantial as a rainbow. But she seldom looked ahead. Each day was so rich that it absorbed her. Now her first feeling was that everything would be different, and that she herself would be a different being to Harney. Instead of remaining separate and absolute, she would be compared with other people, and unknown things would be expected of her. She was too proud to be afraid, but the freedom of her spirit drooped. Harney had not fixed any date for his return. He had said he would have to look about first, and settle things. He had promised to write as soon as there was anything definite to say, and had left her his address, and asked her to write also. But the address frightened her. It was in New York, at a club with a long name in Fifth Avenue. It seemed to raise an insurmountable barrier between them. Once or twice, in the first days, she got out a sheet of paper, and sat looking at it, and trying to think what to say. But she had the feeling that her letter would never reach its destination. As he had never written to anyone farther away than Hepburn. Harney's first letter came after he had been gone about 10 days. It was tender but grave, and bore no resemblance to the gay little notes he had sent her by the freckled boy from Creston River. He spoke positively of his intention of coming back, but named no date, and reminded Charity of their agreement that their plans should not be divulged till he had had time to settle things. When that would be he could not yet foresee, but she could count on his returning as soon as the way was clear. She read the letter with a strange sense of its coming from immeasurable distances, and having lost most of its meaning on the way, and in reply she sent him a colored postcard of Creston Falls, on which she wrote, "With love from Charity." She felt the pitiful inadequacy of this, and understood, with a sense of despair, that in her inability to express herself she must give him an impression of coldness and reluctance. But she could not help it. She could not forget that he had never spoken to her of marriage till Mr. Royal had forced the word from his lips, though as he had not had the strength to shake off the spell that bound her to him, as he had lost all spontaneity of feeling and seemed to herself to be passively awaiting a fate she could not avert. As he had not seen Mr. Royal on her return to the Red House, the morning after her parting from Harney, when she came down from her room, Verena told her that her guardian had gone off to Worcester and Portland. It was the time of year when he usually reported to the insurance agencies he represented, and there was nothing unusual in his departure except its suddenness. She thought little about him, except to be glad he was not there. She kept to herself for the first days, while North Dormer was recovering from its brief plunge into publicity, and the subsiding agitation left her unnoticed. But the faithful ally could not be long avoided. For the first few days after the close of the Old Home Week festivities, Charity escaped her by roaming the hills all day when she was not at her post in the library. But after that a period of rain set in, and one pouring afternoon, Ally, sure that she would find her friend indoors, came around to the Red House with her sewing. The two girls sat upstairs in Charity's room. Charity, her idle hands in her lap, was sunk in a kind of leaden dream, through which she was only half conscious of Ally, who sat opposite her in a low rush bottom chair, her work pinned to her knee, and her thin lips pursed up as she bent above it. "It was my idea running a ribbon through the gauging," she said proudly, drawing back to contemplate the blouse she was trimming. "Tease for Miss Balch." She was awfully pleased. She paused and then added, with a queer tremor in her piping voice, "Darcent have told her I got the idea from one I saw on Julia." Charity raised her eyes listlessly. "Oh, you still see Julia sometimes?" Ally reddened, as if the illusion had escaped her unintentionally. "H, it was a long time ago I seen her with those gaugings." Silence fell again, and Ally presently continued, "Miss Balch left me a whole lot of things to do over this time." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.